Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 1992, features David Kelly, philosopher and founder of the Atlas Society, and Jim Powell, author, journalist, and Cato Senior Fellow. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Jim, you and I both make our living in the realm of ideas. We're both writers. I've been a teacher. You review books and market them, as well as writing quite a few. The question arises, what is an idea? What is this product that we work with and sell that's clearly important, but at the same time, it's a little bit amorphous. It's not like steel or even like a service like computing. I think it'd be interesting to talk about what is an idea.
Well, an idea is, among other things, a thought which guides human action. If we have a high self-esteem or a high thought about ourselves, we are more likely to be friendly, outgoing, to be striving toward what we want, for example. Ideas certainly include inventions, business ideas, as well as all the things that we associate with the arts.
That's interesting. You mentioned the effects of an idea on an individual. Clearly, if you read any psychology at all, you see that people who are happy and successful tend to have a certain set of ideas about, you know, the possibility of success and what it means if they fail, and so forth. What about in the political and cultural realm? Is this the same kind of psychological role for ideas there?
Well, I think many of the ideas that that dominate our lives or that dominate history are often unspoken assumptions. For example, during the 19th century, classical liberalism ideas of limited government dominated. And so when countries came on the world stage like Japan, they liberalized and opened up, not because that was their original thought or deliberate choice, but that's what everybody else was doing and it appeared to be successful. And in the same way, in more recent times, we've seen countries like India, nations in Africa adopt protectionist policies, big government, welfare, the whole thing, not because they dreamed that up, but because they could see that's what almost everybody else was doing. Those were the dominant ideas of the age.
Well, certainly if you look at this century, in a way it's been the century of ideas, big ideas. Socialism was perhaps the biggest of them. It was almost entirely an intellectual movement and guiding force that led to the Russian Revolution and created the communist state, and then now we've seen that idea played out. And when people talk about socialism being dead, what they mean is not necessarily that every socialist economy has collapsed, although most of them have, but that the idea, the ideal, has disappeared. People are no longer drawn to it. But then the question is, why is that? What are the other ideas that took the place of it? You've spent a lot of time observing and writing about it, the international scene and the changes in economies. What would you say are the ideas that led to or have replaced the socialist model?
Well, what often happens typically is that you need a crisis, an economic crisis in particular, to get any kind of significant change. Around the world, we have seen countries start to open up, liberalize, privatize, and so on. And to some degree, this reflects the efforts of bankrupt regimes desperately reaching out for ideas that you might say are in the air, that are respectable and that are very different and might offer a chance to bail them out. In Argentina, for example, you have the ruling government, which is a Peronist government, supposedly in the tradition of Juan Perón, the military colonel who took over Argentina in the 40s and expanded the country so dramatically. You're having the current president is a Peronist, and yet he is on the forefront of privatizing. Supposedly, if you believe what their agenda, they will be privatizing everything within the next 2 years. And that is not so much because they have bought entirely the virtues of capitalism, but because they're bankrupt and they have no other choice. So what you often see is that people are led toward different ideas partially through thinking things out explicitly, and partially they are following the underlying logic which they might not be aware of. In this case of Argentina, they're bankrupt. 85% of their budget deficit is the losses of nationalized companies. So they can see that if they're to stop the runaway inflation, which has brought so much turmoil there, they have to cut government spending. And the only way they can do that is to privatize. Later, it appears that many of the people down there are becoming more aware of the underlying ideas and buying into those. So you have an explicit process of thinking through the ideas, and you also have people coming to the ideas simply by being drawn through the logic of the action.
So in these cases, there's a combination of factors that's partly a matter of people just being able to see that the consequences of central government planning and the collectivist economy, just being able to see that that doesn't work, partly because they can compare what's happening in their, the kind of life they have in their country with the kind of life available elsewhere. Partly it's a matter of, in effect, being forced, as in the case of Argentina, to change the ruling ideas, the ideas that are governing their policies, because that's what's happening elsewhere, and they've got to keep up. I think it's very clear during the 1980s, as the United States and Britain took the lead in reducing tax rates trying to put in place a more stable money and returning to a freer markets. You saw countries all over reducing their tax rates, following suit in all these ways, just in order to keep their businesses from fleeing to these freer regimes. And then partly, I guess, the third factor would be, as you say, simply people, the ideas make sense. People think about them and they can see the internal logic of it. And yet, there's sort of a paradox. If you look at this broad movement we've been talking about toward freer markets and the fact that capitalism has been getting a better name as an idea for a social system. In this country, we don't seem to be undergoing all that much change. That is, what happened in the 80s, not only that has that trend slowed down, even reversed itself in some of the policies that the two presidential candidates this year are recommending. But also, there are a great many people in the press who are attacking what happened and saying it was a mistake. And so I wonder, to what extent is that itself a function of ideas? Is the, in effect, the reaction against this trend? What are the ideas behind that?
Well, you have, it's a long, complex process, and international or national events can disrupt a flow of ideas. For example, during the early 20th century, the world, certainly the United States, was heading in a direction of gradually expanding the role of government. Then all of a sudden, we had the Great Depression, which dramatically accelerated that trend, followed in turn by the Second World War. And certainly in the American experience, during a war, government expenditures tend to have gone up since the Civil War, World War I, World War II, they've gone up by a factor of 10. So you've had events like that come in and dramatically affect the direction. What I think is quite interesting is that around the world, we are seeing one country after the other opening up their economy, trying to curtail the role of government over individuals' lives. So we could say everybody's moving toward capitalism, especially in places like the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, which had been totally dominated by governments. And yet, most people, certainly in the United States, still seem to believe that the morals of the marketplace are deplorable. We're having this remarkable series of books coming out, trashing the 80s, the greed decade, the Reagan administration scandals, Mike Milken, the whole thing. Most people still seem to believe that although capitalism is the only system that can put food on the table, still it's morally tainted. It's we really would not feel comfortable, most people, saying that it is really good or morally superior. And so you might say that the idea of capitalism has a long way to go before the majority of people have really bought onto it as a moral good.
That I think that's certainly true. When you look at the characterization of the 1980s as the decade of greed, it's pretty clear that it's a moral animosity, a moral judgment, rather than an economic judgment per se, although the two sometimes are interwoven. Certainly, a lot of the hostility toward the 80s comes from the fact that a lot of people made a lot of money. And that included a lot of people that a lot of other people think shouldn't have made so much money, perhaps. And the whole idea of making money as a goal from the very beginning of capitalism has always been kind of suspect. In that way, I think it's interesting that in the 18th century, when Adam Smith wrote and people were beginning to understand the emerging capitalist system and the idea of an economy that could keep growing rather than an economic system in which people lived pretty much the same from generation to generation. There began to be some understanding of at the economic level of how that worked, what led to the increasing industrialization and the ability of individuals to make fortunes in a new way by trade and on a scale that had never been seen before. But morally, it's as if our ideas have not changed very much from the time when the basic ethical components of most people's morality emerged, you know, going back to pre-Roman and Greek times, to the day of the Bible. One of them certainly has to do with greed, has always been regarded as, I should say, with the pursuit of money or the pursuit of wealth. I think that there are really two issues here. You might call them implicit assumptions that operate. One is that it's nobler to act for other people, for the community, at least for the family, but for the community and perhaps for the world as a whole, than it is to pursue your own interest. And of course, that's what capitalism is all about, pursuing your self-interest. And the other idea is that somehow wealth itself is ignoble by comparison with art, or love, or knowledge, that the scholar, the artist, is engaged in a higher level pursuit, something more honorable than a businessman or financier. And that these higher realms are creative, they allow for the exercise of individual virtue, imagination, creativity, and as against business, which is basically seeking the almighty dollar, so to speak, is how people describe it, don't call for much intelligence or creativity. Now that, as I say, seems to be functioning as a premise behind a lot of the critique of the 80s, or of more generally of the whole capitalist ethos. And yet it's sort of funny when you think about it, that's not really true, is it? Certainly a lot of what made people rich in the 1980s were really creative, new technologies. You know more about this than I do, certainly, but new financial technologies, so-called junk bonds or leveraged buyouts. What's your perspective on all that?
Well, I absolutely agree with you that the implicit assumptions have an enormous influence. I think you're right that one of the dominating thoughts of the age is that for anything to be moral, noble, worthy of approval, it has to have come from good intentions, and that a system cannot really be worthy unless people are intending to do good. And at the very least, one might start with a look at results. That if you look at the marketplace, you see that, first of all, markets have always been, for thousands of years, the most peaceful places on earth. It has been the opposite of warfare. Merchants cannot thrive if their customers are broke. It's never in the self-interest of merchants to kill their customers. It's never in the self-interest of merchants to kill their suppliers. So marketplaces, merchants, commerce, promotes peace and always has and has always been the opposite of war. it has always been merchants which crossed borders. And regions of Europe, for example, that were at war. It was merchants who were going back and forth, Jewish merchants, Chinese merchants, Armenian merchants, Italian merchants, and many others. It has always been commerce, profit-seeking commerce, which has created wealth, sources of knowledge, independent of government, and which have been absolutely crucial in securing human freedom, not only in the Western world, but in other places where it has developed. It has always been marketplaces which have created very powerful incentives for more moral behavior. Whatever the intentions are, individuals seeking their own self-interest, and yet practically every fortune that you can name, whether you're talking about John D. Rockefeller, Andrew Carnegie, J. Paul Getty, Bill Gates of Microsoft, anybody you care to name, all of those fortunes were based on repeat business. It is very expensive to bring in a new customer. The cost of salesmen, the cost of telephones, the cost of office space, all the things that you have, advertising, all the things you have to do to bring in a new customer. It's a lot cheaper to keep existing people happy. And so in order to make a fortune, you have to keep people happy. You have to treat them honestly, which is why it's impossible to have a mail order business or almost any other retail store without a money back guarantee. It's not necessarily through their goodwill. They have to keep people happy because it's a lot easier to keep existing customers happy. And you do that by offering value for money, by treating people honestly, by treating people with respect. These are the incentives of the marketplace. And so the results are peace, freedom, and moral behavior. They are not necessarily coming from altruistic motives. There is an element of that sometimes, but the primary driver, the most reliable force in history, is self-interest, and it leads to the very fabric of our civilization. I would say that a decent civilization is impossible without markets. And indeed, civilization originated along trade routes, and as all the cultural centers that you might think of, from Florence and Paris and London and New York and all the rest, have all started as commercial centers, and they remain commercial centers. And if they become government centers, primarily a capital, they tend to atrophy. If they are cut off from outside markets, they tend to atrophy and decline. So that if we put aside this dominating assumption of that something has to be good intentions in order to be decent, and we simply look at the results, that's one way of doing it. We can see that the this idea that has dominated our age of good intentions are the criteria of what is decent and honorable, that is entirely wrong.
That's interesting you say that, because it's certainly true from my standpoint, knowing something about the history of philosophy, that morality has almost always been largely a matter of intentions. And most of the moral codes that people have lived by had to do with certain kinds of intentions that it was good to act on, and others that you should not act on. Let's go back to the what you say about commerce breeding peace. Makes sense when you think about it, that the those who live by commerce, whose interest is in trade, will need people that they can trade with. You might also argue, however, that people who live by war need people to fight wars with. It seems to me the key idea here is that trade is a mutual beneficial act, whereas war is what we would now call a zero-sum game, or worse, it's a negative-sum game. That is, in armed conflicts or rivalries for power, there's only a finite amount to go around. Someone's going to have to come out on top, and one person's gain is clearly another person's loss. It seems to me that what makes trade tend toward a peaceful way of interacting with people is that it's a positive sum game, so to speak. That's an economics concept. That means everyone gains from it. There are no losers.
That's right. In a war, you have people are killed on both sides. Somebody wins, but people are killed on both sides. With trade, both sides win, or the exchange does not take place. There has to be some reason why people benefit, or something else happens.
I think that's a distinction that is, and this is really a lesson in how ideas can get compartmentalized. That's an idea, this idea of trade as or exchange as a positive-sum game, is an idea that economists are very familiar with. They've been familiar with it, at least since Adam Smith. That's really what economics is all about, understanding that phenomenon. And yet, it doesn't seem to have affected people's moral judgments very much. You still see commerce described in the press or in people's general sense of it as, in terms of conflict, one person dominating another or beating another, or
the capitalist taking
money.
Political ideas.
Right. That
everything is cast in terms of a power struggle.
And an illustration of that is the very term robber baron, which is used to describe the great capitalists or industrialists mm-hmm. of the late 19th century. I assume that you would argue that these were people who lived by trade and gained by trade and benefited the people with whom they were doing repeat business. And yet in describing them as robber barons, clearly the model, the image that people have in mind is one of conflict, that these were like the princes of the Middle Ages who lived not by trade, but by power.
If they were indeed robbers, I'm sure you would not have had 50 million people come from other countries to the United States as immigrants. It would have been the other way around, as we have seen in all the socialist countries, where people leave as soon as they can, or scale the walls, as the case may be. But sure, it was the entrepreneurs who especially flourished after the Civil War. The names we're all familiar with, Carnegie, Frick, and so on, who created millions of jobs. We had 50 million people come to the United States as immigrants, and yet there were all these jobs created. The unemployment was low. Everybody was finding things to do and dramatically improve their living standards. So that I think the notion of robber barons was one of the more successful idea sales. It's very dramatic when somebody sells an idea that is totally unrelated to the underlying facts. It's just fascinating to see how long an idea can grip people's minds until it finally disintegrates as all the contradictions pile up. It can take a remarkable period of time, and it does testify, in this case, to the power of bad ideas.
It's interesting. This is an example of an idea in history. History is certainly one of the most important sources, I think, of people's sense of political and social ideas, which ones are right. If you discuss anything about capitalism, the discussion, in my experience, will fairly quickly come back to the discussion of that era in American life, the robber barons. And as you say, it was a great great sale of an idea. The idea came from Matthew Josephson in the 1930s, 30, 40 years after this period. And it has been learned as part of the history of the period by millions of people, and incorporated into an automatic sense of that this is obvious. It's obvious that these were bad guys and that this is what capitalism is all about. But that raises another question. Why do ideas, bad ideas, endure like that? I mean, ideas are, after all, as I said at the beginning, they are a product. People, intellectuals work in ideas. They are, in a sense, involved in the process of trying to sell their ideas to others, sometimes literally sell them through book publishing and journalism and all the as commercial ventures, but also sell them in the sense of persuasion, trying to persuade people. Now, if these ideas are wrong, then the question is, why? Why in the marketplace of goods and services, bad products typically don't last that long. Someone comes along and with a better mousetrap and prevails. I wonder why we've had so many ideas that, at least if we think that they're bad, why have they endured?
Well, often they collapse. We're seeing in the news recently about the crisis in Europe because of the Bundesbank wanting to maintain tight money and stop inflation. In that case, what we're seeing is the dominance of the fear of inflation that goes back to 1923, when people were paid in bucket loads of worthless German marks. So there's a case of a very healthy idea, fear of inflation, stopping it early while it is possible to do so easily. In the case of what does one do, how would one pursue a more reasonable discussion of a word like capitalism, which seems to be so loaded that it is perhaps approached more indirectly, perhaps, instead of trying to convince somebody that this abstraction called capitalism is good, and you have all these associations that have accumulated over the decades. Maybe what you do to pursue a discussion is to break it down into component parts. Well, do you believe that people should be free to choose what they buy? Should they be free to choose what occupation, who to work for, where to live, and so on? Well, that's all you're talking about with capitalism. It's not an abstraction. It's a matter of people being completely free to move, to have a right to keep their earnings, to pursue their lives according to their own lights. That's if you say, well, capitalism is markets. Now, that's much more vivid and pictorial. You're putting aside this loaded abstraction and saying, well, this is what you're talking about. People are moving around, they're buying, they're selling, they're pursuing their livelihoods, they're trying this job, that job, they don't like this employer, they go to somebody else. Nobody controls your life but you. That's what we're talking about. It's much easier to perhaps reduce a loaded abstract idea to specific terms that do not have all this intellectual baggage along with it.
But it is interesting. I've often wondered about the, there's a certain asymmetry between the words, just the words, capitalism and socialism. Socialism is a name for a certain social political system, and also the name for the ideology that advocates that system. So if someone says he's a socialist, he means he's someone who advocates a centralized economy, ownership of the means of production, et cetera, and et cetera. Whereas capitalism is also a name for the alternative kind of social political system. And yet if someone calls himself a capitalist, it doesn't mean he has a certain ideology. Usually it means he has a lot of money. Capitalist is a name for someone who owns and uses capital as his, that's his role in the division of labor. The term, that's maybe an historical accident. I believe it was Marx who coined the term capitalism to capture the central role of the capitalist, the private allocation of credit and of investment in a market economy. But it's probably also a function of the fact that capitalism is about markets, as you say, and markets go back a very long time.
They go back perhaps 20,000 years before the beginning of recorded history.
So the idea of the ideas pertaining to markets are almost invariably, necessarily, going to be rather complex and touch a lot of different bases. And I think this is another another reason why people can get wrapped around the axle, so to speak, in thinking about the concept of capitalism. One aspect of that complexity is the difference between thinking in individual terms about the meaning of capitalism as it pertains, say, to you and me, living our own individual lives and trading and interacting, where it means freedom, basically. It means that I have certain rights to use and dispose of both my own abilities and also of the property that I acquire. You do the like. And if we're going to interact, we do so freely by voluntary exchange. That, I would say, is what capitalism means. It means market relationships, voluntary relationships among individuals. And yet, of course, it also means the whole system in which that takes place in a nation or indeed in the world. And when you look at the whole system, economists and political scientists and others, philosophers, have made any number of claims about what that system means and how it works in the large. For example, one thing that indisputably does happen is that there are large inequalities of income. Not larger, perhaps, than in any other system, but they do exist, and some people are become much wealthier than others. You have various other phenomena that people have said are problems with capitalism. Sometimes it's a matter of just economic theory here. For example, one issue is, does the kind of unregulated market necessarily involve, lead to monopolies or lead to depressions or swing, big major swings in the business cycle? That certainly was an idea. The idea that that was the case certainly is one of the ideas that led to the limitations and constraints put on the market in the 1930s and 40s. I would say I'm really talking about two ideas here. One is economic fears about what would happen in an unregulated market. And also certain moral, coming back to moral issues here, moral animosity toward differences in income. So I think people have, it's one thing to look at capitalism at the individual level, so to speak, and you have one view of it there, and then people sometimes in the same frame of mind almost look at it in the large, the macroeconomic level, and think, well, this is there are problems with these systems, with this whole system.
Well, I think what's interesting is that while we're talking about capitalism and socialism, is that both started to a significant degree as moral ideas. It was in the 18th century that you have a number of philosophers such as David Hume and Adam Smith who were celebrating the moral virtues of self-interest and capitalism. Why would they do that? Why would they seemingly celebrate greed? Well, by the 1800s, there had been more than 1,000 years of almost nonstop wars. The Hundred Years' Wars destroyed much of France. The 30 Years' War decimated Germany. The Dutch had been engaged in wars with the with Austria-Hungary for 80 years. In the 1600s, France was fighting the Dutch, who were fighting the English. Between 1689 and 1815, the French and the English fought seven wars with each other. So there was one war after the other. Usually they were just nonstop. They went on for years. And so from the vantage point of people who had seen 1,000 years of bloodshed for as kings pushed around borders, the markets were a wondrous, moral, peaceful sanctuary. It was a blessed place to be because they could appreciate the contrast. Now, socialism began germinating in the 19th century. There were precursors, of course, but it began as a moral idea. Now, right. This is good intentions and communal socialism. They didn't have a clue how to run an economy. Marx never presented any vision of central planning. That came later with Lenin. But it started as a moral idea, and it turned out, I think we would say in retrospect, that the moral idea of capitalism has been vindicated in practice, and the moral idea of socialism has hit the rocks around the world.
That certainly is true in terms of what we can see to be the consequences. And yet I have some reservations, which I can bring out by going back, as you say, to the 18th century when the concept of capitalism was emerging. You're absolutely right, against the background of all this warfare and bloodshed and the horrible religious wars over ideas, over different religious beliefs, and all the other wars for all the other purposes, trade seemed to the philosophers and other thinkers at that time to be a vast improvement. I think it was Samuel Johnson who said there are a few things about which a man can be more innocently engaged than in making money, meaning, if he was after money, he was probably going to be acting in a more or less peaceable way, for all the reasons that we discussed before. And yet, there was still always a sense, even then, by these early advocates of the market system, that this was not a particularly honorable or heroic mode of life. It was just more peaceful. And we've had enough heroics in battle before. But not honorable, not heroic, because there was, I think, a lingering sense that self-interest, that people shouldn't, after all, be involved in pursuing their self-interest. And conversely, when the socialist idea emerged in the 19th century, it was based partly on some fanciful economic theories that Marx had, which were falsified very quickly. But I think the main impetus for it, the reason it drew millions and millions of supporters led to the dominance of that ideology in the whole Eastern Bloc for almost a century, the reason was moral. Socialism presented itself as a system that would allow and require people to act in a way that a lot of people regarded as moral, living for others. The term altruism, for example, was actually coined by one of the early socialists, Auguste Comte, to mean otherism, live for others, merge yourself with the group, with humanity. And it was very clearly a reaction against the ideas of individualism that we associate with the Enlightenment. One of the authors that I'm very interested in, Ayn Rand, the novelist and philosopher Ayn Rand, always made the point that capitalism never fully had the moral defense, the moral foundation that it required, because although we had the principles of individual rights and the idea of the right to your own life, the right to your liberty, even the right to the pursuit of your happiness, still the activity at the ethical level, the activity of pursuing your happiness was regarded as safe, but a little questionable. And then, of course, it was vulnerable to people who came along with a new creed promising a new way of living a morally idealistic life. And so I think this is an interesting case of where, at a very, very deep level, really an implicit level of ideas, that assumptions that people make, ideas have had a tremendous impact.
I think we have seen in the last 100 years abundant experience with both socialist regimes and with more limited governments where markets dominate economic activity. So we are in a position now that people were not so much 100 years ago to compare and see where do you tend to find a higher level of moral behavior? Where do you tend to find more honest dealings? Where do individuals tend to treat each other with more respect? Where do you find more sensitivity toward others? And although people tend to be preoccupied and saying, well, this or that merchant is terrible and Mike Milken is terrible and so on, if you get yourself back to making a comparison, well, what's the alternative? Is to have some bureaucrats and politicians performing the same function? What happens when we compare the performance of private individuals versus people who have a lot of political power? And we find that again and again, as Lord Acton remarked, power tends to corrupt everywhere, in Africa, in Europe, in Asia, in the United States as well. And I think it is not a coincidence or an accident that we tend to find a higher level of moral behavior in marketplaces where there are bad people in government and in marketplaces, but in marketplaces, there is a limit to how much damage bad people can do. There's no known way of keeping bad people out of political power. And when they get there, they harm millions. They kill millions when the wars they start. So I would say, getting back to the importance of ideas, we find a higher level of moral behavior in marketplaces. It is not accidental, and it is we can evaluate the ideas by looking in the world and seeing how do people actually behave.
Well, it's interesting. Now, you mentioned the contrast between the economic ways of arranging our affairs and the political ones. What we have now is a government that allows a market but highly regulates it and takes about a third of, I think if you take all levels of government, takes about a third of the national income to spend on its own. So it's very significant modification of a market society. And that includes then a number of activities that are today being performed by political rather than by economic means. If we go back to what we were saying before about the difference between the real robber barons, that is the ones who lived by conflict, who lived in a struggle for political power versus the entrepreneurs and capitalists who live by trade. It, to some extent, it looks as if today's interest group politics that involves this constant struggle for resources in Washington, for control of the regulatory agencies, for subsidies from the various through the various programs that offer subsidies, and so on and so forth, that what we have here is not an armed, violent kind of political struggle anymore, but still definitely a political struggle, even if it's being waged by lawyers in Gucci's rather than by knights in armor. It is not an economic exchange, but a political one. And has the same characteristics, namely that it is not a zero-sum game. That when you and I go to Washington, you to lobby for one program, for one benefit, and me to lobby for an incompatible one, one of us is going to lose. Or if we both win, someone else is going to lose. That because we're talking simply about taking money out of one person's pocket and putting it into another. The question is what ideas sustain that? I mean, haven't we been here before? Haven't we seen the benefits of open free exchange? Why have we gone back to what is essentially a fight over the spoils of plunder?
Well, one thing I think is noteworthy here is that what do you do about bad ideas? Plunder. What do you do about bad ideas? In a marketplace, it's fairly easy to get rid of bad ideas. They die when they conflict with enough facts. People can try a particular business venture. You can try writing a book, and if it doesn't work, that's the end of it. But if you try applying a bad idea to political power, you almost never get rid of it. Someone had the idea that the government should run the post office, and most people would agree that the service is terrible. In many cases, records indicate that delivery between places like, for example, New York and Philadelphia are no better than they were when Ben Franklin was running the post office. But you can't get rid of it because you have all the interest groups who are politically supporting this bad idea. The idea that we should support farmers because they keep them in the parity of 1913 prices. It's a terrible idea. It costs us $30 billion a year. It disrupts trade. It harms poor people, forcing food prices up. No matter how bad that idea was, because it became part of government policy, it is politically very, very difficult to eliminate. So on the question of what do we do about bad ideas, I would think that the answer is to keep markets as open as possible so that we can go by trial and error, trial and success.
All of the cases you mentioned are cases in which people, as you say, come to have a vested interest. And of course, when people do have a vested interest, they will always, many of them anyway, will fight to preserve that interest. And the reason we have still a government post office system and don't allow anyone else to compete with the post office, or at least for first class mail, is that everyone, not everyone, some people fear that that's going to mean closing down rural post offices or special privileges that our people are getting through the postal system because it's non-competitive. And of course, you find the same thing throughout the existing government. For every program, there are interests that want to keep that program. And yet, no one is going to come forward and say openly, I'm keeping this program because it's in my interest, even if everyone else's ox is being gored. There's almost always a rationale, an excuse. You might say it's hypocritical, it's not the real one, but it's the one that has to be put forward for public consumption. And to serve in that role has to have at least some plausibility to enough people to make it fly. And clearly, one of the key ideas here, I think, is the idea of an entitlement. That is, that there are certain things people are entitled to from the government. An entitlement is a right. It means you have the right for this, just as if you and I sign a contract. I'm then entitled, once I've paid, done my share of it, I'm entitled to have you follow through. Or at an even deeper level, I'm entitled to my freedom. I have the freedom of speech. It means I have the right to speak freely and I don't need anyone else's permission. But the entitlements that we're talking about are entitlements to certain goods and services from government, to a Social Security check that not only arrives every month, but increases once a year in accordance with inflation and so forth. right to medical care, right to an education, to housing, and so forth. These are the programs that are being operated now by political rather than economic means. And I would say one of the key things that is keeping them in existence is the notion that people have rights to these goods, which means rights to have certain other people provide them with those goods through the medium of government.
Well, yes, I think your reference to entitlements is a great illustration of the power of ideas. The implicit idea that we should always focus on the needs of people and not on the way of satisfying those needs. For example, to focus on the plight of New York City. It's a terrible problem, and therefore Washington should come to the aid of New York. And yet, if you ask what's really going on, what you're asking is not just does New York City have some needs, but is it right to be taxing, for Washington to be taxing people in South Dakota to pay for improving the New York City subway system? Lee Iacocca wants to be bailed out from mismanagement at Chrysler, and you focus on Lee Iacocca and Chrysler, and you say, oh, that's terrible, they're going to lose jobs and so on. But what he's really talking about is putting up higher tariffs, taxes, keeping preventing American consumers from their freedom of choice to buy whatever it is that they need, and restricting their choice so they have to bail out. So we're saying it's only appropriate to look at the need and not to look at the process of whose pocket you're picking. I remember, who was it, Will Rogers, who said, whenever I see a politician standing up on a platform and talking about doing good, I reach for my wallet to make sure it's still there.
You're right about the concept of need. That is the driving force and what makes people feel they have these entitlements. The problem is that the concept of need and the idea that one person's need becomes a claim on everyone else is a principle that I think people derive from their experience in families, which do operate that way. A family is a collective unit and whose function is to nurture everyone in it. And when one person has a need, the whole family tries to satisfy it. And yet, the economy, the society, the nation, is not in any literal sense a family. And in our modern liberal individualist society, it's very specifically not a family. It is an association of individuals who have their own individual rights, which includes the right to autonomy. So we have a melding of, I think, ideas that are really incompatible. On the one hand, the idea of a right, an entitlement is a need that has become a right. But that's where the contradiction comes in, because on the one hand, a right is a right to be an individual, to act by your own lights, your judgment, for your own purposes, and to deal with people, to interact with them and provide for their needs, but voluntarily. It's a rejection of the claim that you have any kind of intrinsic claim on me without offering me value in exchange. That's the right element in the package. And then the need element is, as you say, New York City's in trouble, everyone else has to help. If Chrysler's in trouble, everyone has to help. If the farmers are in trouble, and so on and so forth. We've tried to merge the concept of rights with a really quite alien concept of the whole society as a family, a concept that goes back, is much more primitive, much earlier than the capitalist mode of society.
Well, as you've noted, many bad things over the years have been sold under seemingly noble ideas. You think about tariffs, which have always created harm, have always impoverished people, have always undermined the incentive of companies to be competitive. And so you've seen every country which has ever adopted high border restrictions has experienced stagnation, decline, backwardness, and corruption. And yet, each restriction is sold not because the car companies want to line their pockets and get higher profit margins, but they appeal to the idea of the national interest, the fishing net people and the tuna fishermen and the car companies. They all claim to be in our national interest. So what I think we have to do is align our ideas with reality.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.